tried to do it in this short of time before, so I'm not going to guarantee that I'm going to leave time at the end for questions. I'll be around until Tuesday at 1:45 when the bus leaves, and I'd be delighted to talk to you about these topics anytime before then. Actually, I'd be delighted to after that, but it'd be harder to find me. Part of the reason I think that I was asked to write this history that I'm writing for Greenwood Press is that I came to the study of American Lutheranism through the study of women's history. And so my perspective, my questions, and my methods are perhaps a little different than the standard of denominational histories that we've had in American Lutheranism. Until now, this has been the standard book. And every time I read it, I like it better. Every time I assign it to my students, they tell me it's deadly. I'm not using it this fall. Finally, I've stopped completely. The topic tonight is American Lutherans. Who have we been? There is an unasked question behind that, and that is, who will we be? Because my interest in history is not merely antiquarian. It is with the assumption that the present and the future have something to learn from the past, and that the present and the future are influenced by the past, whether we pay attention to it or not. So there's this unasked question, and who will we be? In a time of Protestant decline, in a time of demographic change, in a time of religious variety. We can't be precisely who we have been, but I hope that who we have been can help us learn who we will be in the face of changing circumstances, so that we won't just have, as a memorial, a gravestone. Right? I put this up partly because I always make this joke with my students that I'm a historian. I spend a lot of time with dead people. But that's not the reason here. It's I hope that in our present context, we can learn from the past in such a way that we don't end up with Lutherans just being dead people. Right up front, I want to say two things about what we'll find out from the past. The first is that the stereotypes and caricatures of Lutherans are false. And the second is that the stereotypes and caricatures of Lutherans have a basis in reality. Okay, so that on the one hand, this Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church, one of the most famous current stereotypes about Lutherans, of course, comes from Garrison Keillor, who is himself now a convert to Lutheranism. There's this stereotype that he has put out over the airwaves of what we're like. We're Midwestern, we're Scandinavian or German, we're rural, we're isolated, we're quietistic, that is, we don't get involved in politics or social issues or anything controversial. We're non-cooperative, we don't like to work with other Christians. Often we don't even like to work with other Lutherans. We are argumentative and we're good singers. Some of that has a basis in reality, and some of it is a distortion. Lutherans have been portrayed by American religious historians usually as an exception to the rule, kind of like Dutch Calvinists. I see Steve Tong has come in. He's from Grand Rapids. He knows about Dutch Calvinists. Well, we usually end up in the same chapter as exceptions that don't fit the rules. And when we get public notice, like on that famous Cheers episode when Woody was getting married, and I haven't seen it, everyone tells it to me, I can't remember whether he was Missouri Synod and his wife-to-be was ELCA or the reverse. But when something like that, they even notice us, we're shocked. My students came up to me in class, there were Lutherans on Cheers. Well, no one says there were Catholics. There were Jews on, everyone expects that, and even Episcopalians. But Lutherans were sort of surprised if anyone notices us. Okay, so far the question then. Who have we been? Who will we be? What's the context? We need also to say something initially about who we will ask these questions of. Whose past are we talking about? The standard approach has been to look at the institution, particularly the institution as it is nationally, to look at the leaders, particularly the clerical leaders. That means it's mostly been highly educated male clergy who have been of importance in these kinds of histories. Now, that's not entirely true here, but several of my friends have taken classes where they've used this book and they've gone through and counted up how many women are mentioned, you know, and it's like 12 or something. It's really a small number. That's because of where you put your camera or where you do your looking. My approach is somewhat different. I tend to look, first of all, at local congregations rather than, first of all, at the national organization. I tend to look at lay people, especially women. And until 1970, of course, in American Lutheranism, if you looked at women, by definition, you looked at lay people. At this point, I should say that I think probably at this point, the most understudied group in the study of American religion is laymen. They're the most understudied. And then thirdly, I tend to take ethnicity as a problem rather than as a given. The other way of doing things, these are the kinds of people I want to look at, right? This is the congregation at Vasa Lutheran. It's in southeastern Minnesota on a midsummer Mission Fest picnic in 1904. And I would argue that that's as important a piece of the history of American Lutheranism, of who we have been, as any national convention. We need to pay attention to this kind of activity too. Generally then, the standard approach has given us a kind of chart. This is my modification of the chart. Usually they have straight lines, and on this side there are about a whole bunch of them. At one point there were 66 different synods of American Lutherans. And then they kind of blend together. So three will become one, and then five will become one, until we get down here, and then suddenly we have two big ones and some little ones. It gives you the impression that we go from having had many things to having had few, to now having few things. What I've tried to do, the actual things on here aren't really significant. What I've tried to do is to visualize this institutional history more on the model of a river. Okay, and those of you who know me and my husband, of course, wouldn't be surprised that I'd be thinking about rivers and sort of geological metaphors and so forth. But I think the advantage here is it shows that we start with many small things and we don't end up with one small thing, but we end up with something that grows, that these things flow together. And also, if we have the river as the metaphor, we have the option of thinking about rain, that water comes in here from other places. Or, you know, maybe a spring suddenly appears down here and we get some new water in there. So that it's not just the old immigrants and their offspring who make up Lutheranism. So I think we need a way of thinking about ourselves that is more complex and more subtle than what has generally been the case. Now tonight what I'd like to do is to give you a basic plot line with some indication of the issues that are relevant today and to try and complicate things a little bit. To complicate things so that the story is not simply this one. This is the general plot. Lutherans immigrated from Northern Europe. They made lots of synods. They argued with each other. Gradually they joined together, and now there are fewer synods. Okay, I want to make it a little more complicated than that. And I'll do that in six chronological periods. Let me just say them really fast. These are my titles, my little phrases for them. Scattered Beginnings, Planting a Church, American Lutheranism ? New Beginnings, Maturation and Consolidation, and American Reformation ? Okay. So, here we go. Back into history to look at some of the places we've been. Scattered Beginnings, this is what was going on before the American Revolution, and I'd indicate three scattered beginnings. What happens in New Sweden, what happens in Georgia with the Salzburger settlement, and what happens in New Amsterdam. And unfortunately, I don't have pictures for New Sweden or New Amsterdam. So I have here a small catechism. New Sweden was a colony. It's unusual in the history of American Lutheranism in that it was a officially sanctioned effort by people from a country which had a state Lutheran church to establish a colony. Consequently, at least for part of the time of the existence of New Sweden, the people there were provided by royal authority with clerical leadership. And at least one of those clerics, John Campanius, also took very seriously that he was to do mission work among the native peoples. And so I put up Luther's Small Catechism. He translated Luther's Small Catechism into, I think it's an Iroquois dialect in the 1600s. It's the first piece of Christian literature that was translated into a Native American language. It wasn't published right away, and by the time it got published and sent back, it was relatively useless, but it was done. So, from New Sweden, we have, on the one hand, this unusual circumstance governmentally, but also it's worth noting that this early effort of Lutherans in the United States, which wasn't the United States yet, was also missionary. That's contrary to our stereotype, that Lutherans never did anything for anyone except themselves until at least, 1968, right? Well, this is more like 1668. Okay, then another group prior to the revolution is the Salzburgers. They're also unusual. They were religious refugees. By and large, the immigrants who make up the first membership of Lutheran churches in the United States do not come here for religious freedom. They come here for purely economic reasons. They come here, by and large, we can find some exceptions like the Salzburgers, as individual immigrants, not as groups, and not because of any sort of religious persecution. Mostly they come from places where Lutheranism is the established church. The Salzburgers are unusual in that regard. They were kicked out of Salzburg by a Roman Catholic leader. They came here by way of London. They settled in Georgia. They had a self-contained colony which endured about until the American Revolution. So again, it's scattered. These first two things are relatively unenduring. I have absolutely no picture at all to show you about New Amsterdam, which of course becomes New York. But in its early years, when it was under Dutch leadership, there was a small minority of Lutherans who had come from Holland, who wanted to gather for worship. The Dutch officials would not let them do it. This is about the closest Lutherans come to religious persecution in the United States. It's nothing like having a convent burned down. It's nothing like what happens to Jews. And it's relatively minor. So I think one of the reasons Lutherans tend not to show up in the standard histories of American religion is that on the one hand, we're relatively unexotic. And on the other hand, and we don't get in enough trouble. Okay. If you get in more trouble, if you get persecuted more, you're more likely to show up. Doesn't happen to us. New Amsterdam is important because the Lutheran population there was non-established. They weren't the majority religion, and they didn't have a lot of authority. It's really the local constitution from New Amsterdam that sets the standard for many local congregational constitutions well into this century. So that I think it's very important in terms of polity, how we organize ourselves. The notion that the members of the congregation have an important role to play in the governing of the congregation. One other thing to say about the pre-revolutionary period, and that is that the first congregation of Lutherans that was established in New Jersey was started in the home of an African. Okay, pre-revolution. So again, that stereotype that American Lutherans are always Scandinavian or German is laid bare early on. Now it's laid bare with a very small exception, right? I don't want to make it sound like, oh, gee, there's always been lots and lots of African-American Lutherans. But also I don't want us to think that there weren't any until 1950. Okay, the first New Jersey congregation was started by an African. The second chronological period I call planting a church because that's the motto of this man, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, who came here actually in pre-revolutionary era, but he begins the process of making American Lutheranism something that can endure. It's not just little scattered bits here and there. He comes from the University of Halle in Germany, which was the center of Lutheran pietism. He was trained to go into foreign missions. Wow, this is very important. It's a reoccurring theme. Again and again, important clerical leaders come to the United States because they were thinking of going on a foreign mission and they couldn't go to India or they couldn't go to Africa. They thought of the United States as a mission field. Even though they would be working largely with their own kind, it wasn't a good posting, right? What you hoped is you'd come over here, you'd work for 10 years or something, and you'd get to go home, right? Not that you would stay here. He came here as a very young man, and he found a situation which he understood to be quite chaotic. One of his rivals, Count Zinzendorf, was trying to organize a group of churches on the basis of their common German heritage. Muhlenberg rejected that. And he said, no, we are not sectarians. We're not going to go with the Moravians and the radical reform groups. We are Lutherans. The basis of our cooperation will be confessional. And so he united himself with some of the Swedes in particular, rather than with Zinzendorf, choosing a religious basis for cooperation rather than a cultural, ethnic one. Two other things about Muhlenberg's own career. Among the things he did, well, this I've already said, was to organize the Ministerium of Pennsylvania in 1748. That's the first extra-local organization. That is to say, the first time that congregations began to work together. And then the things that they were concerned about, this is the second thing I wanted to say, included common worship patterns, an effort to take from the customs of the various places that the immigrants had immigrated from and find some common pattern for Lutherans in the United States. Not all of Muhlenberg's sons and descendants remained Lutheran. It's interesting for me to observe that both William Penn, the famous Quaker founder of Pennsylvania, and Henry Melchior Muhlenberg had sons who became Episcopalians. I don't know quite what that means, except that it points out that part of the American context is not only religious pluralism, but religious mobility. People tend to choose which group they want to be part of. Okay. Also in the period of planting a church, we get some expansion. I have pictures of three, and here, of course, I'm doing exactly what I said we shouldn't do, namely to look at the leaders as the way to talk about the church. It's what I have pictures of, and it's the quickest way. When I come to one of the other periods, I'm going to show you pictures of congregational life. Pictures of three men to indicate three different directions of expansion. This is John Stow. This represents expansion west into the frontier of Ohio. Remember, it's frontier in those years. John Stout was raised up from the congregations or from the people. There weren't really congregations out there on the frontier. So unlike Muhlenberg, who was an import, Stout comes from the American soil to be a leader of American Lutheranism and a pastor. He didn't have quite the educational credentials which would later be required. But in that frontier period, there had to be some innovation to take care of what was needed. Second is John Bachman. He also was native born. He did, however, receive a more conventional education. And Bachman, I have up here to represent the expansion into the South. We don't often think of American Lutheranism as being very big in the South, and frankly, it's not. But in some areas, it was bigger than others, North Carolina in particular. John Bachman, I also have up here, because of some of the things that he personally was involved in, he was a collaborator with Audubon, the bird guy, right? And in fact, a couple of Bachman's daughters married Audubon's sons, so it was a very close connection. Bachman was a naturalist. He was very interested in the natural sciences, and one of the things that he wrote is a treatise on the single origin of the human race. In the early 19th century, there was a lot of discussion about whether, in particular, Africans and Europeans, black people and white people, had the same origin. And many people, most of the most prominent scientists, argued that these were of totally different origin. John Bachman wrote a little treatise, which I have read, arguing that this is not the case on the basis of all sorts of other animal examples. I was hoping that he would be a shining star of sort of wonderful view of racial relations above. Well, it turns out when you read it, he's not entirely free of racism, but at least he was a step ahead of some of the people around him. Then John Kunze is Muhlenberg's son-in-law, and he worked in New York City. I put him up here to give me an opportunity to say that Americanization is already beginning as we come out of the Revolution into the early 19th century. The Ministerium of New York switched its official language to English early on. It would later have to switch back to German, but I point this out to illustrate that the question about how to be American and what language should we use, actually it started much sooner than this, but has been a constant question for American Lutherans. How to be Lutheran in this place? Will we only be, to use the metaphor Muhlenberg uses, of planting, a horticultural metaphor, will we only be a kind of hothouse plant that's been transplanted into foreign soil and can be kept going by extraordinary means? Or can we indigenize in some way and become something that lives here? Okay. Well, that's really the question of the third period, an American church question mark. This Eastern Lutheranism, we sometimes call it, I call it the Muhlenberg Lutherans, by the middle of the 19th century, are asking questions like, what shall we do about English? What distinctive doctrines do we want to keep? Or will we become more like other Protestants? Should we keep a Puritan Sabbath? Lutherans had not kept a Puritan Sabbath. They didn't sit quietly on Sunday and just read. They were Germans, right? Germans were more lively on Sundays than Puritans. Shall we take part in revivalism? These were some of the things that were being debated in the 19th century, even as Lutheran institutions were being formed. And here's an illustration of the Lutheran Seminary at Gettysburg, which was the first one that was founded. And one of the people who was involved in that is Samuel Simon Schmucker. I love to say this, Samuel Simon Schmucker. His father was also a Lutheran clergyman. Samuel Simon Schmucker was educated at Princeton, because when he was a young man, there was no Gettysburg Seminary. So he had contact with American Protestantism. And he thought there were things to be learned from it and ways in which we should delve into our heritage. He starts out his life sounding very confessional, and by the end, he is seen as the diluter of the Lutheran confessional heritage, the Lutheran theological heritage. Although it came out anonymously, it's generally understood that he was the author of something called the Definite Synodical Platform, which proposed some alterations in a key Lutheran theological document, the Augsburg Confession. For example, Schmucker suggested that our understanding of original sin could be softened a little, that our understanding of how Christ is present in the Eucharist could be altered a little bit. His proposal was... It had some people who were in favor of it, but mostly it was rejected by people like the Henkels. This is Paul Henkel. He was the progenitor of a huge dynasty in Southern Lutheranism, and they were also advocates. They were advocates of the use of English, but they were very interested that the distinctly Lutheran way of being Christian would be preserved. And consequently, among the things they did was to found a publishing house called the Henkel Press, which is in New Market, Virginia. Another more conservative voice was that of Charles Porterfield Krauth. Again, the son of a Lutheran clergyman. His father was Charles Philip Krauth, and he helped to found the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, or at Mount Airy. Those two, Gettysburg and Mount Airy, have been rivals since the founding of Mount Airy, and continue to be till today, in a way, so that you, any of you who are following the study of theological education in the ELCA, know that one of the issues is how many seminaries we have. And again, recommendations will be made that we should have fewer. And it's obvious that Philadelphia and Gettysburg, they're like really close together, you know? And maybe they could go together, but there's this long history of antagonism between the two. It's not really personal between the faculties anymore, although it was at one time. The Civil War, I should just make mention of, because my students always say, what happened to the Civil War? Why don't we talk about the Civil War? By and large, the Civil War was not a big issue for Lutherans. We did have a synodical division, the formation of the United Synod South, and people fought, and the Battle of Gettysburg had dramatic ramifications for Gettysburg Seminary. Of course, some of the buildings were used as hospitals and so forth. But by and large, it wasn't a big issue. There were a few notorious soldiers. This is Hans Mattsson. He was a Swedish immigrant from Minnesota who was the leader of one of the few Minnesota units that was ethnically comprised. I just got the other day in the mail a press release that in October there will be a big memorial celebration for Hans Mattsson at Fort Snelling in St. Paul, so I imagine I'll have to go. Maybe I'll take some of my students for a field trip. The other way that the Civil War was important, and I think it's worth mentioning, among the Norwegian Lutherans, among who there were only a few of them, is the debate about whether slavery was good or was evil or a sin became really a dispute about how to interpret the Bible. Three things that were a result. One, the lay people said to the trained theologians, well, whether it's a sin or an evil, on the basis of biblical interpretation, doesn't matter to us. It's clear it's wrong, right? So this lay people sort of rising up and saying, look, we understand. Listen to us. Secondly, as a result of that, Norwegian Lutherans stopped using Concordia Seminary in St. Louis to train their pastors, and Luther College in Decorah was founded. And thirdly, the hermeneutical debate about the Bible continued after the Civil War was over. Okay, so the question of interpretation endured past the practical issue that raised it. So remember I said there is some basis for the stereotypes. We are argumentative. Now, whether or not that's always bad, I think is problematic, something that one would need to talk about. Okay, the fourth thing is new beginnings, and this really overlaps with the an American church period. New beginnings in two regards. The first is that there are new people, and the second is that there are new activities. So here you see a map of Norwegian settlement patterns in Illinois and Wisconsin. The story of these people's arrival and how they develop repeats what had already happened earlier, and it repeats for all the groups, more or less the same plot. Norwegians, Swedes, Finns, Icelanders, late arriving Germans, etc. So I've mixed up all my pictures here, and I'm just going to kind of run through that pattern. Log cabins, they're on the frontier. What had been the frontier early on was like New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and then Ohio, and now in the mid-19th to early 20th century, it's Missouri, Nebraska, Minnesota, the Dakotas. So these people, by and large, arrive on the frontier. And they organize local congregations, first of all, and the first they meet in people's houses, barns, and groves, and then they get little churches like this. It kind of looks like the River Sauna. And inside it might look like this, very plain, not much music. This is a one-string instrument that you play with a bow. And they probably don't have services very often. because it's a, because we're using essentially circuit riders. You read the logs of those clergy. They give services whatever day they arrive in a settlement. They do weddings, baptisms, confirmations, marathon. And if they haven't been there for a long time, you know, sometimes they're doing baptisms for the children of people whose weddings they did in the morning. Because there was no one to do it, you know. This is this one is the first church that was built at Vaasa, the picnic people. And, oops, excuse me, I'm going the wrong way. And this is the third church that they built. So you can see the economic development. As the people are more stable, then they can build more bigger and more remarkable buildings. These are three shots from the inside of Vaasa. I put it up especially just because I love this pulpit. I don't know if you can see, but it's an open Bible that holds up the place where you set the books. That's one of the things that Lutherans are not unique for, but are pretty distinctive about, is the use of a lectionary and the expectation that the Bible will always be at the center of preaching. Okay. These small congregations were providing for both spiritual and social needs. You had to have a congregation, you had to have a pastor in order to have baptism. Well, you didn't have to. And any of you who have read Past Giants on the Earth into the other volumes of that trilogy may have remembered the wonderful thing that happens when Peter Victorious marries an Irish Catholic. Both sets of grandparents secretly baptize the baby. The Norwegian Lutherans secretly baptize it and name it Olaf Patrick. And the Catholic grandparents also baptize it. Everyone wants to make sure that happens. Also, many of these groups had parochial schools to do both secular and religious education. It holds on more among the Germans than among the Scandinavians. The Scandinavians were more willing to avail themselves of the common schools once those were established. And confirmation, of course, was a major rite of passage, not only religiously, but also socially. In these communities, it was a mark of adulthood. Once you were confirmed, you were a grown-up early on. One of the things I haven't ever taken time to do, but I'm really curious to look at all these confirmation pictures and discover when the girls start wearing white dresses. They don't always wear white dresses. Okay. Women's organizations were very important and sometimes preceded the formation of the congregation. Often were responsible for the funds by which the first church was built, by which the parsonage was built, by which the organ was purchased, by which the pastor got his money, etc. But I put this one up particularly so that you can see that there are children there. And sometimes, especially in the early years, the Ladies' Aid was really the social organization of the congregation. And in some pictures, you see pictures, the men are also there. Sometimes the men were the officers of the women's organization. I think the women's organizations are very important for the transition from being a state church, which is tax supported, to the American situation where there are not tax support. Then this is a junior mission girls. Youth organizations in many congregations begin from the young women's organization, which then becomes a youth organization here, a Wartburg League, one of the German congregations. Other things that went on in those congregations is that, of course, choirs were formed. And what is initially a very cohesive group gets subdivided in a variety of ways, by gender, by age, by function. We expect choirs, we don't expect a band, so I just put in the Vaasa band because it's unexpected. Also, life cycle things were taken care of in the congregations. This is a wedding of one of the sort of aristocratic families of Norwegian Lutheranism. Wedding anniversaries, funerals. All of these were things that took place in the congregations. and worship was central. This is, happens to be a Norwegian Lutheran congregation. Those of you who take care of that sort of thing might want to know. I think this is the heating element right here. The other thing to note is that men and women are sitting on opposite sides. Especially these immigrant congregations were very peculiar to the Yankees. I've read a description of the St. John's Lutheran in Northfield, written in the Northfield News, and when they dedicated a new building, and the reporter commented on this, that men and women sat on different sides, and thereby compared Lutherans to Jews. That was the best comparison that this person could think of. They weren't like Congregationalists, that was sure. So not like other Protestants. Then each of these groups had their own leaders. They formed their own organization. I'm just going to flip through some of the leaders. A couple of Swedes. The Swedes, one of their claims to fame is that they didn't splinter, that the Augustana Synod was relatively cohesive. That's partly because the Swedes, who had various ideas, generally formed other groups. Like my great-grandfather, Lagerquist, who immigrated to the United States, did so because he became a Baptist, and he was told there were no Baptists in that family. The Norwegians, on the other hand, all stayed Lutheran. And when they came to the United States and didn't have the state church to hold them together, I think it's like when a rubber band is tightly around something and you take it off and it just all over. And that happened with the Norwegians, so that they had different synods based not only on ethnicity but also different styles of piety and also different doctrinal emphases. So there's the Lutheran Free Church, another Norwegian leaders. These are two of the earliest leaders of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And it's worth noting that it's the one that, when you draw that chart, it's pretty much a straight line until 1970s, when there's a group that breaks off. They have stayed very cohesive. And they came as religious refugees. They were opposed to the efforts to reunite what in Germany are called the Reform and the Evangelicals, what we call the Calvinists and the Lutherans. They thought that was unionism, evil unionism. I have a friend who grew up in the Missouri Synod. He said he was an adult before he knew that the Prussian Union was not really called the evil Prussian Union. Stefan was the one who brought them here. He proved himself to be a less than worthy leader, shall we say. And C.F.W. Walther then was really the one who formed the Missouri Synod and helped to establish its various supportive institutions. All of these groups did this. They had their own newspaper, their own publishing house, their own college, their own seminary, all the sorts of things that were required to keep the group going. The sorts of new that's Old Concordia Seminary that the Missouri Synod found. If any of you have seen the current Missouri Synod Seminary in St. Louis, it's somewhat more impressive. Okay, new activities, new things that once Lutherans felt more established, they branched out into. I compare this to the difference between moving house every year and having to spend all your energy on things like getting curtains and finding out where the grocery store is and sending out changes of dress cards so you never get beyond that, and living in the same place for 5 years so you can actually begin to put down roots. When all those new immigrants came, it was like pouring cold water into a boiling pot. The Americanization process that was well underway for the Muhlenberg Lutherans was in a way arrested by all these newcomers. The Ministerium of New York went back to German. But as things became established, new activities began. And these I would put in some different categories. Social ministries, like this orphanage, like hospitals, often gave Lutherans an opportunity to look beyond their own kind. Especially hospitals were a place where Lutherans came into contact to people who were unlike them. I should say something I should have said earlier about immigration. The Norwegians were absolutely the most retentive with regard to religion. That is, what I mean by that is 25% of Norwegian immigrants who we can assume came from Lutheran homes remained Lutheran. That's the highest percentage. Danes, I think, are about 7%. Partly that has to do with the vigorous evangelization of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, the Danes, the Mormons in Denmark, who brought a lot over. But not, we shouldn't assume that all Scandinavians and Germans were Lutheran when they got here. Many ceased to be. They became other things, or they just sort of became unchurched, shall we say. Okay, so social ministries. Another thing that was new was the beginning of the use of deaconesses, particularly William Passavant, who's out of the Eastern Muhlenberg tradition. This is Elizabeth Fetty, a Norwegian, who was very active, particularly with hospitals, both in Brooklyn and Minneapolis. It never was a very big movement, but it was an important one, particularly in social ministry. Hospitals and various kinds of social work. Then another kind of new activity is foreign missions. Here you see a family who were missionaries in China. Other places that American Lutherans had missions were in India, South Africa, and Madagascar. And those of you who know much about Namibia today, the largest percentage of Christians in Namibia are Lutherans, and it's the result of this early mission activity. Okay, zipping right along. Do you want to just take a breath? Okay, the next period I put from about 1920 to the middle part of this century. 1920 is important for two reasons, one external and one internal. It's when there was new immigration legislation in the United States, which reduced the immigration to the U.S. So that source of cold water declined. Okay. Another reason it's important is sort of symbolic, but had important ramifications, is that 1917 is the quadricentennial of Luther's 95 Theses, and it was celebrated by Lutherans and by other Protestants in the United States. So it was an opportunity to stop and think about identity, to get a little visibility, to think about relationships among Lutherans. Other things that are happening then are an increase of economic stability among Lutherans, and of course, war. Right? It's also right about this time. War was very important for the Americanization process of Lutherans as well as Roman Catholics. Here's a point of real similarity with Roman Catholics, who along with Jews and probably the Eastern Orthodox are the best comparative groups, and Dutch Calvinists, for understanding Lutheranism. This is a building at Camp Dodge, Iowa. One of the things the war did was mean that Lutherans needed to minister to their own who were in the armed services, and the government wouldn't deal with every little synod. They said, we don't understand why there are so many of you. Figure out who's going to talk, and we'll talk to one of you. You know, that was sort of the government attitude. So it forced Lutherans to work together. So that gradually we'll have, this is the National Lutheran Council in about 1920, various activities for which Lutherans cooperate among themselves. Ministry to the armed forces is one, and response to European needs is another. How to help Lutherans in Europe who are displaced. Refugee work with displaced people, is something that American Lutherans can be very proud of. It's one of the things we have done extremely well with. And initially it was indeed, we'll admit it, service to one's own. The other thing that came out of the war was the need for Lutherans to show that they had matured. They were no longer dependent on Europeans to send them leadership, education, or any of that stuff. Not only were they not dependent, they were able to provide help. One of the very obvious places was for what are called the orphaned missions. Various missions particularly run by Germans, who as the result of war were without staff. And American Lutherans did a great deal to attend to that. This is really the beginning of the Lutheran World Federation today. One other thing about the war is the anti-German feeling. It's very important for the Americanization of the German Lutherans. During this, both the First and Second World War, Germans of all religious groups had to really prove that they were Americans, and that meant they did things like change the mascots of their schools, change the names of their sports teams, and this is another place where Lutherans come close to feeling some sort of persecution. There were efforts to require the use of English in parochial schools. And an interesting way that Catholics and Lutherans cooperated in mostly the upper Midwest was in opposition to those efforts. Okay, so I said maturation and consolidation. Consolidation, we begin with 1890, a whole bunch of mergers. In 1890 and 1917, the Norwegians come together. Actually, that's these. Well, it's way up here in 1890, and then in 1917. Also in 1917, all the, if you will, the Muhlenberg family of Lutherans form the United Lutheran Church, and that was a direct result of the quadricentennial cooperation. They'd been working together on this celebration, and I get the impression from reading the documents that it's sort of like someone was sitting around and said, gee, wouldn't it be neat if for the quadricentennial we reunited? And it was as if it was an event waiting to happen. In 1930, many of the German groups united in what's now the old American Lutheran Church. This also united the women's organizations. And those of you who are here to see my slides on American religious women have seen this slide of Catherine Lehman, who was an executive in the old Women's Missionary Federations and then also in the ALC. Other mergers took place in the middle of the century, in 1960 and in 1963. These are the three men who were presidents of the merging bodies that formed the old ALC, with headquarters in Minneapolis in 1960. And then the three men who were president of the Lutheran Church in America that formed in 1963. Okay, then we come to the final period, which I call an American Reformation question mark. I take this from an essay by Yaroslav Pelikan, in which he argues that American Lutheranism has followed the opposite pattern of European, which went from a Reformation to a period of orthodoxy to a period of pietism, that American Lutheranism was founded in pietism. Muhlenberg, coming from the University of Halle, for example, entered a period of orthodoxy and may now be on the verge of a new Reformation. What might lead us to think that? Well, there certainly are some things that have changed since mid-century. In 1970, the ordination of women was a major change. We have increased membership of and leadership by people of color. Now, I've been arguing all along, I think you've heard me dropping this in, that these people have been Lutherans, people who aren't Norwegians and Swedes and Germans, have been Lutherans for a long time. But there's an increased visibility, an increasing willingness to say, hey, look, I'm not that. And also for some of the people who have that familial heritage, it's not as important as it once was. So that's why I think when we look back, and I haven't been able to do it too much tonight, we need to talk about ethnicity as a problem or something to think, to question, rather than as a given. This increased leadership is evidenced by things like the election of Nelson Trout as district president in the South Pacific District of the ALC, the election of Will Hertzfeld as the presiding bishop of the Association the splinter group from the Missouri Synod, of Sherman Hicks as bishop of Metro New York, Gwen Carr as president of women of the ELCA, etc. Another important issue has been ecumenism, relationship between Lutheran churches and other churches. This is a picture of Bishop Crumley of the LCA meeting with Pope John Paul II. This is a point of much controversy. What are the appropriate ecumenical relationships? Should we be moving towards some kind of organic union? Do we do that sort of the way you do with tennis? You always want to play with someone better than you. How does that work? Here we have a picture of Herb and Corinne Chilstrom, of course, in 1988 with the formation of the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. We're down to two main bodies from 66. That's also a new and important part of what might be a new American Reformation. So we end with a sort of baptism picture and say, leave you with a question. If being Lutheran is something that one becomes via baptism, not by birth, if its central theological insights concern God's gracious acceptance of us without regard for our culture, then what will these things say about who we will be? I think it will say, among other things, that ethnicity has been both a bane and a blessing, that membership has not always been only white, that there are pragmatic as well as ideological reasons for our isolation, that how to be American has always been an issue, and that we have always been learning how to expand our understanding of being a Lutheran. That's a point of continuity, that we're always learning how to be Lutheran and what is central to that and what is peripheral, and to use the Reformation term, what is adiaphora, what is of no consequence. There are about 3 minutes before the bell rings. And if you have questions you'd like to ask or comments you'd like to make after that very fast tour through several hundred years, I'm delighted to entertain those now or later. Dean is leaning forward.
Politics, Lutherans and politics, does seem to be a very bleak history.
Well, yeah, it's bleaker if you look nationally rather than regionally or locally.
Right.
I think that's an important thing to say. Yeah, it has been.
Because I know the chaplain of the House of the Senate, I forget, is a Lutheran.
Right.
I forget which one it is.
Right. And several governors in Minnesota have been Lutheran. Some of us are hoping that our next governor will be John Marty, who's going to run for governor in the next race. So we'll have another Lutheran there. But it's tended to be more locally, sometimes state. And that's one of the places where the stereotype has a basis in fact. We have been better at... if you accept the distinction, at charity than justice, better at direct aid than systemic change. I don't think that our doctrine requires that. I was going to suggest if things you might be interested in reading, if you're thinking about, not so much about history, but where are we going, I think one of the most interesting pieces of Lutheran theological work that's come out, yes, I went and checked, have the right title, it's called Theology and the Black Experience. It's a set of essays that come from a conference several years ago in Harare, Zimbabwe, which brought together African-American and African Lutheran theologians, and they look very carefully at central Lutheran teachings like the Two Kingdoms Doctrine, which is one that's often cited as the basis of our not being involved in politics. I think when I say there are pragmatic as well as ideological reasons, I think part of the reason has been settlement patterns, that Lutherans have tended to be clumped together. And so in those little areas, they've been involved, but not in larger areas. It's a complicated issue. But yeah, there's some basis in fact for that stereotype. I don't think it has to be the case. Yeah. Bob.
What kind of efforts is the ELCA making to broaden our ethnic base?
There's a whole strategy for this, and I sit on the steering committee for the Commission for Multicultural Ministries. If you're interested, there's a plan that's out there on the desk. It's a pink paper. It's for multicultural church. They're doing lots of leadership training. I think there's always there's a little skittishness about not wanting to appear to be scalp hunters, right? And not to appear to be poaching, say, on the Baptist membership. So that a lot of it's leadership and training leaders, trying to put, and this is not always the case, but often trying to put money into congregational development in neighborhoods where the population is very diverse.
Because when you look at a place like Namibia where they have, where most of them are lived in, you can have well-trained clergy,
yeah.
strong.
That's quality. Exactly right. And the director for the Commission of Multicultural Ministries, Fred Rajan, is a native of South India. And he always begins by saying the majority of Lutherans globally are not Europeans and Americans. They're Namibians, Malagasies, Indians, etc. So the problem is not theology. The problem is something else. Right, yeah.
Here in the United States, using that as a frame of reference, you say we've gone from 66 synods down to two main ones. Are we just about at the end of that?
Yeah. Yeah, I am not hopeful that there will be another merger in my lifetime for two reasons. One, I don't think it's likely to happen. Two, I think it wouldn't be productive at this point. Merging, well, remember moving in with a roommate, you know, and or remember even more if you're married, when you get married, how much energy that consumes. Figuring out where how we're going to keep things in the refrigerator. You know, you put the cheese in two containers or one container is enough. How will we wash dishes? What will our name be? All of those things take enormous energy. So I don't think we have the energy for it right now. The other, I don't think it's likely. I don't think the Missouri Synod is the least bit interested. And the other thing that study of mergers of congregations has shown us is that, generally speaking, if you merge two congregations in a given period of time, I think it's about a decade, the merged congregation will have reduced itself to the size of the largest of the two predecessors. So I have real mixed feelings about merger. I think it's important. I'm glad that we've gotten where we've gotten, but I don't expect us to do any more, nor would I be an advocate of trying to do more.
How far behind is the Wisconsin Synod in membership?
It's teeny.
Is that similar to
your... Well, there are a couple others. There's a Finnish group. Yeah, and there are some other, but they're real little. Yeah. Others? Sven?
I was surprised that you mentioned the Lutheran Church in Namibia, because I thought most of the credit went to the Finnish Lutheran Church for that.
Well, I know there was an important German mission in that part of South Africa that American Lutherans cooperated with. So I may be overstating the involvement of American Lutherans there. Well, thank you very much. Like I said, I'm happy to talk to you about this more, and I hope that you go away with your stereotypes a little bit complicated. Thank you.
Thank you.